Okay, thanks for the invitation to come here to this wonderful facility. It's just, you know, Princeton wasn't cold enough, so decided to come here. So today I'd like to tell you a bit about... That's right, it's like going home. So today I'd like to tell you a bit about some work I've done, a series of papers with Andy Strominger and Si Yin. We were motivated by the suggestive relation between four-dimensional BPS black holes and a topological string that was noticed last year by Ogeri, Strominger, and Bafa. The black holes we're talking about here come from type 2 string theory, compacted by atomic fermion threefold n. So they have n equals 2 supersymmetry, both the compactification has n equals 2 supersymmetry in four dimensions, and the BPS black holes will, in general, preserve half of that. For concreteness, let's focus today on type 2a compactification, just for simplicity. And to understand this relation of OSV, we need to review a bit about type 2 compactification on Clavier. So the first thing to remember is the well-known fact that so the Clavier M has Kähler and complex structure moduli, which then become vector and hypermultiplets of the effective n equals 2 theory in four dimensions, respectively. So wrapping d-brains on appropriate cycles on the Clavier, we get BPS black holes in four dimensions. And these black holes will then be, will then, you know, interact with the vector and the hypermultiplets in a certain way. So that interaction is known as the attractor mechanism, which tells us that the vector multiplet beds are fixed at the horizon to be a function only of the charges of the black hole. So this black hole, in general, will have a number of U1 charges, be charged under a number of U1 gauge fields that arise in this compactification, and these we will just generically call P and Q, to stand for a large set of these charges, and here we kind of split them up into like half, one half being electric and the other half being magnetic. So that's just some notation. So this is the statement of the attractor mechanism where these functions F are known. If I specify the Clavier, we can compute these functions F, and this tells us how the vector multiplets are fixed at the horizon. And the interesting side fact here is that the hypermultiplets are completely unconstrained by the attractor mechanism. So we only have, morally speaking, half of the moduli being fixed by the attractor mechanism. And since we expect the entropy to be the log of an integer, we don't expect it to depend at all on hypermultiplets, which are free to vary at the horizon. So this means that the black hole entropy we expect to be a function only of these attractor fixed vector multiplet beds. Okay. So that's interesting, because now if we look at the other thing that people look at in these, one of the other things that people look at in these compactifications on Clavier is the topological string, which is supposed to compute some physical quantities in the vector four-dimensional theory. So this is my one slide review of the topological string. So since we're doing type 2A compactification, we're going to consider the A model, which in general, the topological string A or B model computes the prepotential, which is called F top, which is then has an expansion, which is like a genus expansion in terms of the topological string coupling G top, and these individual prepotential terms here, which depend only on X lambda, which are, for the Clavier, they're the Kähler moduli, and for us, they're the vector multiplets, the effective 40 theory. So the important thing here is that the topological string only depends on the Kähler moduli or vector multiplet beds. And moreover, each term in the prepotential, so the fact that the topological string only depends on X lambda, these vector multiplet beds, already suggests that there's some relationship between the topological string and black hole entropy, since they both only depend on the same set of moduli of the compactification. So we can make this more concrete when we remember that each term in the prepotential sort of calculates the coupling of the effective 4D Lagrangian, which couples the supergravity multiplet W together with the vector multiplets X lambda. So So each term has a specific power of W associated with it. And if you expand this out in components, you see the leading term here is an R squared coupling. So this is a higher order, higher derivative modification to Einstein gravity. And so this is a direct sort of modification of Einstein gravity that you get from the string application at higher orders in alpha prime. For each term in the free potential, we have such a term. And so we would expect these to modify the entropy law because they involve curvature. In fact, thanks to the work of Wall, he worked kind of in general, and then these people worked in the specific context of n equals 2 supergravity. They showed that these higher derivative couplings do modify the area law for black hole entropy in a very specific way. Their analysis was kind of very, very detailed. And at the end of the day, they had a pretty simple looking formula, which I'll show you on the next slide. So the important thing to know also is that all other terms in the effective Lagrangian that you get from this string application are supposed to depend on, so they argue that these other terms are supposed to always depend on the hypermultiple embeds. And so we don't expect them to affect black hole entropy. Okay? So they didn't actually compute all these terms and show using the Wall formula that they don't affect the entropy. But this is a general argument that the entropy can't depend on any of the hypermultiples. Okay? So basically what we've shown in words here is that the topological string, which tells us what these terms here are, is computing the only terms in the effective Lagrangian which will modify the area law for the entropy. And so we've arrived at a precise relation between topological string and black hole entropy. And to really write it down in the formula, I would have to tell you what these people did. But so the contribution of Ogure, Schrödinger, and Bockwith was to rewrite their result in a very nice way involving topological string. So this is their contribution here, basically. They showed that the relationship between topological string and black hole entropy takes this very nice form. The black hole entropy here appears on the right-hand side, it's a function of the charges, and classically is 1/4 of the horizon area. But this will, in general, include all the quantum corrections that you get from the string application. And on the left-hand side, we have a funny object. We have 2 times the real part of F top, the topological string, free potential. And this is a function of these vector multiple embeds, which are themselves functions of the black hole charges. And this equation, together with this equation, is a statement, the precise statement of the attractor mechanism. So you have the vector multiple embeds at the horizon being fixed in terms of the charges. Okay? And you have this funny extra term here, minus Q lambda phi lambda, which this is basically the main contribution of the main effect of all these higher derivative terms is to contribute this extra term here. And if you just look at this, it immediately suggests some sort of thermodynamic interpretation, I think. So this equation taken together with this equation suggests that what we're doing here is some kind of Legendre transform between a canonical ensemble and a mixed ensemble, right? Where we're exchanging these electric charges, Q lambda, for their potentials, phi lambda. Okay, so taken as a Legendre transform, this naturally suggests this would be some kind of thermodynamic relation. And this naturally suggests some sort of statistical, mechanical, some sort of more microscopic relation. And this was the next step that OSB took in their paper. They conjectured an exact relationship between something and something, which where the left-hand side now is sort of the non-perturbative partition function of the topological string, which will asymptotically go like e to the f top, but will include all these corrections that we currently don't know how to compute. And then the right-hand side here will involve some sort of black hole degeneracy, partition function, index, what have you, which again, asymptotically, will go like e to the entropy, but then will include all these corrections. And then the relationship here will be not a Legendre transform, but a discrete Laplace transform. And you can just see that the saddle point, this is designed to work at the saddle point level, because if you just take the saddle point, the saddle point equation for Q, which we're summing over here, it's like an integral, we can approximate this with saddle point equation for Q, which is precisely this equation here. And then substituting back into here, we will get this relation here. Okay. So this is called the OSV conjecture, but I hope I've communicated to you that it's really more like a conjecture about the existence of a conjecture, because it's extremely imprecise right now. Hence the squiggly that I've drawn. So there's a long list of things that we could complain about. My favorite one is not very deep at all. It's the simple observation that, you know, if you just look at this, here we're summing over integers q, so the right-hand side here is clearly going to be invariant under shifts of phi by 2 pi I times an integer. But the left-hand side, okay, you'll just have to take my word for it, but the left-hand side in general, in the cases where we can compute this guy, at least all orders of perturbation theory, you know, the f-top, where f-top sort of truncates, there are examples like that. It's clear that this thing has no such periodicity. So, okay, this can't be inequality as is. It has to be more complicated.
Could any other corrections you're talking about fix the problem?
It's unlikely because, it's unlikely that it would conspire like that. In fact, in the examples that we will study today, we'll see that there it really is modified. Okay, that's a good question. And other examples that have been studied in the past also show that it's modified. Okay, so that's complaint number one. Complaint number two and three are similar. They just say that, well, for the topological string, we don't have a non-perturbative definition of it. It's only defined as an asymptotic series, this partition function. So what is the correct z-top to put in this formula? What is the correct non-perturbative definition for the topological string? Okay, so that's just a general question. And on the black hole side, we also have the question of what is the correct black hole degeneracy to use? In general, people talk not about the entropy, but about various sort of topological BPS indices, which asymptotically go like the entropy. And then there's the question of which index are we supposed to use, because in general, you can define a whole series of indices which count the same black hole entropy. These are called Felicity supertraces. And so there's an ambiguity of which one to plug into this formula in general. Or also the recent work about black hole counting indices in n=1 superformal theory suggests that sometimes the index might not even reproduce black hole entropy, in which case you have to, what are you supposed to put in there? I mean, it's got to be something which is, you would hope that it's something which is topological in nature. Okay. And finally, the last point here is another kind of obvious question. It's just that here we kind of guess this exact relation, based on the saddle point approximation. So you could ask whether there are non-trivial measure factors on either side of the relation, which you don't pick up when you look at the asymptotics. Okay, so that's my laundry list of complaints. And today we'll try to address some of these. And the idea is that we need a better understanding of both sides. We need to know what to put in to compare in order to refine and formulate the OSV conjecture precisely. Okay, in particular, since the black hole defining the topological string non-perturbatively is very hard, and it's very hard. So in particular, it looks like a nice place to make progress would be to find exact expressions for black hole degeneracy. And topological string aside, this would be, this is an interesting physics question in general. How can we compute these things exactly? So unfortunately, for n equals 2 compactifications, these exact formulas are very hard to come by because Clavius in general are very complicated. Even the simplest examples are too complicated, it seems, for our current technology to be able to calculate these degeneracies of all orders. So this suggests that we go to theories with more supersymmetry and there try to calculate these degeneracies. And so this has motivated us to study black holes in n equals 4 and n equals 8 string theory, which you get from compactifying type 2a or type 2b on a sort of a non-generic Clavius. In this case, the simplest possibility is k3 times q2, which has, and in this case, the possibility we considered is t6. So in both cases, these Clavius have smaller than SU3 holonomy, so they have, they're depending on how you define Clavius, they're either not Clavius or they're very non-generic Clavius. Okay.
So what did you hope to learn from studying those cases with more supersymmetry?
Perhaps I should say, so the motivation is to understand the OSB conjecture, formulated more precisely. And in these cases, we also know the topological string side, at least to all orders of perturbation theory. So here is an example. These are examples where we know both sides to some degree of accuracy that we can now compare. Okay, but you know, here we have to actually calculate these degeneracies. So that's what we're going to do. Okay, so in this talk, that's what we're going to do. We're going to derive formulas for the exact degeneracies of PPS black holes in n equals 4 and n equals 8 string theory. Here I've written large because in these theories, or in general, you can consider black holes which are either large or small, and this refers to whether the classical entropy, the horizon area, is classically vanishing or non-vanishing. So the large ones are the nice ones. They make sense in the classical limit, and the small ones only make sense kind of in some sort of quantum description. Okay, so we'll be talking about the large ones for which the OSB conjecture, the original relationship of OSB was kind of derived, where they worked only with the classical plus perturbative corrections. Okay, so we'll talk about the large ones, and we will then exhibit at the end the OSB transform of these degeneracies and compare them with the topological string. Okay. So the outline is as follows. We've done the motivation. And the next thing I'll talk about is the 4D-5D connection, which is the crucial ingredient in our derivation of these degeneracies. This is a relationship between 4D and 5D black holes, which was derived recently by Davide Gaiotto, Strominger, and Yin. Then we'll use this connection to get our formulas for our black holes of interest, and then we'll compare topological string. So the first part of the talk is the 4D-5D connection, which I want to talk about briefly. So for concreteness, again, let's consider type 2A on the Clavius 3M with a specific configuration of D-brakes. We could consider a more general one, but this one will suffice for today. We'll put a single D6 brain and wrap it on the entire Clavius M. We'll take a number of D2 brains, QA, and wrap them on cycles alpha A in M. And we'll put a number of D0 brains anywhere in M. Okay, so this is a BPS configuration for type 2A on M. And now we're going to lift it to M theory. And because of the D6 brain, we get something interesting. So just with the D6 brain, what you would get is a Taubnut space, which looks like this. It looks like a four-dimensional cigar. So you should imagine a five-dimensional person here smoking it. And so at the tip, it looks like R4. And at the asymptotic way out here, I guess it creates an infinite cigar. It'll take you a long time to enjoy it. And so asymptotically here, at r goes to infinity, you have a fixed radius r here which is related to the 10D string coupling like that. So if it weren't for the D6 brain, of course, this would be the usual N-theory lift, and this tip would also go off infinity, and you just have a cylinder with the gradients R. Okay, but because of the D6 brain, it cuts off here like that. Okay, so that's just how nuts fade. And now, recall we have D2 and D0 brains also, and because of that, we're going to get a black hole in this 4D, well, in this sort of 5D geometry here. Okay, so the D2 brains will lift M2 brains, which sit at the tip of top nut, and then the D0 brains lift angular momentum. So now we have a spinning black hole sitting at the tip of top nut. Okay? Now the reason it's angular momentum is easy to see. Ordinarily, they would lift to momentum along the x11 direction, but in this case, they're sitting at the tip. So here, this momentum along the x11 direction becomes spin sitting at the tip. Okay? And they're related in this way with the coefficient of a half. The angular momentum and the zero brain charge are related with this coefficient of a half, which we'll understand later when we match the classical entropies of these black holes. Okay. So now it's clear what we're going to do, hopefully. This radius R here is a continuous parameter, which we can dial to be whatever we want. If we take R to 0, we're back to 2a in 4 dimensions, magnified on the Clavial M. And if we take R to infinity, we get a 5D black hole. And so since the microscopic degeneracy we're ultimately going to calculate shouldn't depend on this continuous parameter R, we expect that the 4D and 5D degeneracies are exactly equal. So when we take R to infinity and R to 0, the degeneracy doesn't change. And this gives us a relation then between D5 and D4, which will be appropriately defined. Okay? So this is the statement of the 4D-5D connection that Kyle just from here in the info. Okay, in some cases, the 5D degeneracies are known exactly, and that's what we're going to use to derive our 4D degeneracies. These cases that we'll consider are ones involving D1 and D5 rings, which have been extensively studied in the past. Okay. Yes?
Again,
because the degeneracy is ultimately some integer. It'll be trace of minus one, so it'll be a sum over states weighted by minus one to the sum.
Can't some state just for some stupid reason get some energy?
Yes, but the integer we expect can only jump discontinuously to another integer, and so at least locally. If we change R by a little bit, we don't expect this degeneracy to change. So apart from these issues of jumping, we expect that something like this is true.
Yeah, but I mean it's similar to lines of marginal stability.
Yeah.
Like that. So there could be something which makes things jump.
Yeah, I guess. Okay, we're going to assume that this doesn't happen, and you can check classically that you get total breathing. So at least leading order is definitely not happening.
Well, you have more supersymmetry, does that rule out the problem you're
talking about?
Well, no, but the statement of the 45D correspondence is for n equals to so n equals 2. But these things are all BPS.
But later on, you're going to look at a specific case where there's...
That's right. We're going to, in this talk, we're going to consider more supersymmetry examples.
So your question is a question for us, Roman, your GM?
Yeah, no.
No, I'm just saying. They claim it's true for n.
Yeah, I think that's certainly the simplest possibility. I mean, barring any sort of bizarre phase transitions at some finite value of R, which there's really no evidence for. I don't think that these lines of marginal stability can be an issue. Okay, but yeah, these things are good to worry about when we get to the level of detail that we will get to in the talk. Okay. So anyway, like I said, you can check this classically. And classically, at least, you see that for all possible, you can just check explicitly that there's no issue and that the entropy is agreed. So that gives us confidence that this is working. So the classical thing I'm referring to is on the 4D side, we have the D62D0 entropy formula, which was derived using the attractor formalism by Shmakova. And she showed that it looks like this. Where Q cubed is this complicated combination of the charges, which so it's related in this way. Okay, so that's what it is. Amazingly, it agrees with the entropy of the 5D spinning black hole with the most general set of 5D charges. And the original 5D spinning black hole was considered by Breckenridge, Myers, Keaton, Baffa, who considered a specific set of charges. And this was generalized by Kloch, Rajaraman, and Wang. And they showed it looks like this. And with the same Q cubed after we make these, so the, these now become M2 brain charges. So it's the same Q cubed, and Q0 is related to J left. This confirms the factors I have. Okay? So this is a very precise agreement, which didn't have to be the case if these lines of marginal stability were issued. Okay. So that's all I want to say about the general 4D-5D correspondence. Now I want to talk about the examples that we studied. There are no more questions.
But this is for K3 cross T2. Right?
Where?
I mean this agreement.
No. This is for all. This formula is derived for all black holes, and this is this one. M theory on Fabio, M theory, the type 2A. Well, the compactification will be n equals 2 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions, and these are DPS black holes.
So in principle, there could have been curves of marginal stability.
Yeah. But they're not there. I mean, these formulas were derived a long time ago by these people, and they never noticed that they're the same. So they didn't have any reason for them. Okay. So yeah, let's move on to talk about examples now. First one is string theory on K3 times T2, which preserves n equals 4 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. The u-duality group in this case is has two factors, SL2Z and the integer subgroup of SL22,6. So this factor here is like the familiar electric-magnetic duality. And this factor here is like a generalized T-duality, which comes from the K3 times T2. Okay. So the electric and magnetic charge vectors there are 28 of them, and they transform in the fundamental of SO22,6. So we'll call them QE and QM. We can form three invariants of SO22,6 out of these charges, and it will be convenient to form them into a 2x2 matrix like this, which then transforms as in the adjoint of SL2Z. So that's the way it transforms under the remaining u-duality. Okay, so the simplest possibility consistent with u-duality then is that our 4D degeneracies, whatever they are, depend only on these three duality invariants and in an SL2Z invariant way. So this is some modular form, SL2Z. Sorry, well, it's invariant under SL2Z. Okay. So that's the simplest possibility. You could consider more complicated possibilities because these aren't the only, I said these are the only SO22,6 invariants, but they're not the only SO22,6Z invariants. So there are more refined invariants that you could construct. I haven't done so explicitly, but I am told they exist. But we're just going to assume that the degeneracy formula we talked about today doesn't depend on anything. Okay? So I think that's a mild assumption. And so now the goal is to use the 4D-5D connection to derive some exact formula for D4. And to proceed further, we have to take the 5D system, which is some configuration of M2 brains and spin, we have to take that into one whose degeneracies are exactly known. So there's a series of dualities that will do that for us. To be specific, let's consider again D62, D0 configuration with a single D6 brain, and now we have a number of D2 brains wrapping K3 and wrapping T2, and a number of D0 brains. Notice there's no D2 brains that wrap both K3 and T2 because K3 has no holomorphic one cycle. Okay. So the SO22,6 invariants that we defined before, in this case, you'll have to take my word for it, but they reduce now to these three values. Here, CABC is the intersection form on H2 of K3. And so this is, in particular, it has signature 19,3. So it's a 22 by 22 matrix with signature 19,3. So this is like a K3 invariant, and the D0 brains are related to this dot product of the QE and QM, and the D2 brains that wrap the T2 are related to the magnetic charge vector. Okay. So now the series of dualities I mentioned is as follows. We start with M theory on K3 times T2 with our M2 brains and angular momentum. First step is to shrink an S1 inside the T2. So basically, we exchange the M theory circle with one of the circles in T2. This brings us back to type 2A, but now on K3 times S1. And now our D2 brain, M2 brains become T2 brains. These M2 brains, which wrap the T2, now become S string, and the angular momentum stays as is. So now a T duality will take us to 2B, and our D2 brains will become D3 brains. The momentum, so the S strings become momentum along the S1. And angular momentum doesn't change. Finally, a general u-duality we know will change this D3 brain system into a D1 defined system with a single D5 brain and a number of D1 brains. And everything else staying the same. Okay, and so if you follow this duality, you find the following relationship between the final D1 D5 charges, the momentum, the number of D1 brains, and the angular momentum, and the original 4D charges. And it just looks like this. So there's a nice separation of the original charges into the 5D charges. And if you promote this to the u-duality invariant statement, it looks like this. Okay. So now the natural thing to do in five dimensions is to form a generating function or a partition function for the 5D degeneracies, where we sum over all of these charges here and weight them with these potentials rho, sigma, and nu. And this is now a function of rho, sigma, and nu, which is the generating function for the degeneracy. By the 4D, 5D correspondence, we expect that the 4D degeneracy, this is now a definition of the 4D degeneracy, but we expect that it looks like this. And you see how the duality invariants come out. And the 4D generating function that we define is then related to the 5D generating function with this extra little factor here, which comes because of this plus one. Okay, so now the goal, now all that remains is to compute C5D, and it has two parts, with one that comes from the D1, D5 system, and so that's the D1, D1 strings and D1, D5 strings, and then the other part is just the partition function of the D5 brain. We have a single, remember, we have a single D5 brain and N D1 brains. So the second part is the partition function of the D5 brain. Okay? So in the past, this part was, people studied the D1 D5 system and compared with the classical entropy and with subleading corrections, but they never studied this guy here because it only contributes non-perturbatively, so they kind of missed it. But we'll find that we need it for the u-duality to get the u-duality invariant result. So now the most technical part is to calculate these two guys. But it's all standard stuff. The microstates of the spinning D1 D5 system were first studied by BMPB, as I said before. They're described by the world volume CFT on the ND1 brains, which move so that the ND1 brains wrap the circle and move in the K3. And so this, in the limit that the K3 is small and the circle is large, the CFT is a nonlinear sigma model with target space given by a symmetric product of n copies of K3. So these are the endpoints in the K3 that describe D1 brains. So this is a singular space in general, and the resolution of it is called the Hilbert scheme of endpoints on K3. Okay, that's not too important for us. But the important thing is that the degeneracies of this CFT, this target space, are known exactly. Okay? So what are they? Well, they're described by this mathematical object known as the elliptic genus, which in our language is this supersymmetric trace weighted by -1 to the these quantum numbers here. And we trace over L0 and J left with a fixed n. Okay? And so this is now a generating function for some degeneracies, which I'll call d5 prime, which at a fixed n. So the full partition function that we're after involves all, so the full generating function that we're after involves all values of n, so we should sum over n now weighted by another potential sigma. Okay? Okay, so this quantity has been calculated. And it was calculated in the physics literature, at least, by Dijkgraaf, Moore, Gerlinde, and Gerlinde. And they derived a funny looking product formula for it. And it looks like this. OK, this is not too illuminating. One interesting thing about it is that it involves the elliptic genus coefficient C for a single copy of K3. So that is they had some sort of physical interpretation for this in terms of a long string. But so this is an interesting feature of this formula. It involves these elliptic genus coefficients. You have a relationship between the elliptic genus on n copies of K3 and the elliptic genus on a single copy of K3. Okay. So the other part of this formula is the partition function of a single D5 ring wrapping K3 times S1, and it has some angular momentum. So this is dual to some hadronic string on T5 with some angular momentum. This was calculated by a long time ago. The hadronic partition function was calculated a long time ago by Antoniadis, Scotland, Rain, and Taylor, and they found this funny product formula for it. The amazing thing, which they didn't notice and have no reason to notice, is that you can write it in terms of these elliptic genus coefficients of a single K3 again, where now we multiply, take the product over a different range of K, L, and N. Okay. So why is this nice? Well, before we had this product over some range of K, L, and N. And here we have a product over a different range of K, L, and N. And these are now going to combine to give us a bigger product of the same thing over a larger range of K, L, and N. And this is our final formula for the 5D degeneracy. Now, if we use the 5D-4D correspondence, this gives us a formula for the 4D degeneracy. And it looks like this. Okay. So why is this interesting? Well, there's a number of reasons. I think the most interesting reason is that this exactly reproduces an old conjecture of Dijkgraaf, Gerlinde, and Gerlinde in 95 or so. So they wrote this paper where they conjectured a degeneracy formula of these dionic black holes, these large black holes, in factorization of K3 on K3 times T2. They conjectured their formula, and they had a number of arguments for it. But I think this is the cleanest derivation of their formula. And you know, we arrived at this using a totally different approach. So that gives us confidence that we're on the right track. This formula is also interesting because, as we learned from this paper, this partition function is the unique weight 10. It has nice mathematical properties. It's the unique weight 10 automorphic form of SP2Z, which is like SO3,2. And so this contains inside of it SL2Z, which is identified with the U-duality group. And so this, because it's an weight 10 automorphic form, it transforms under SP2Z in a non-trivial way. But the SL2Z factor, you can check, leaves this thing invariant. So that's the statement of that's the remaining U-duality that we have to check. And so that I've said here. So you can check that the 4D degeneracy that you extract from this partition function is manifestly U-duality invariant, as it has to be. And that also tells us that this factor of the 5D, the extra factor of the D5 ring partition function is crucial for this U-duality to work in the end. Otherwise, we wouldn't have gotten the weight 10 automorphic form. Okay, and this automorphic form has other properties which allow us to calculate, as originally done in the DVV paper, allows us to calculate the asymptotics of this degeneracy, and you can check then that asymptotically it goes like e to the entropy. So in this case, at least the index that we've computed is calculating the entropy to the leading order. Okay, good. So that's our formula for the 4D degeneracies. Now I'm going to talk briefly about the n equals 8 example.
So if you do not include the five-brain partition function, you even get the wrong classicalism that you're saying?
No, no, the classical bit will work. These this extra product here doesn't affect the classical products.
But you mentioned on the next, on the next transparency, you mentioned so this the classical result is usuality in the end, right?
Yes.
You mentioned that without the T5 partition function, you will not get
the full one.
So the full one. But okay, this is the.
Yeah, I mean, the classical result is equivalent here. Yeah, but what I'm saying is that if I didn't include that thing, the full one would have lower order terms that are.
But it doesn't contribute to what it's.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Yeah,
this, I mean, if it did contribute, people would have noticed it before because people studied this, the classical comparison a lot. Good. So now I'm going to talk quickly about T6. It's going to be very similar to this example. So string theory on T6 preserves even more supersymmetry, n equals 8 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. Now the u-duality group is much larger, it's E7, and it turns out that there's a unique quartic charge invariant that can form with this u-duality group, and this is known as the Kramer-Julia invariant. It's too complicated to write out in full generality, but if you truncate to a set of n equals 4 charges, then it looks like this. Which is nice because we're also told from people who've analyzed this that the classical entropy goes in general like pi times square root j. And so this agrees with the n equals 4. The n equals 4 truncation agrees with what we saw on the previous slide, which is that the entropy looks like this. Okay. So that's the Kramer-Julia invariant for n equals 4 truncation. And the simplest possibility consistent with u-duality is that 4D degeneracies depend only on j. Now this is similar in spirit to the assumption we made for the n equals 4 degeneracies, where we assume that it only depends on the continuous SO22,6 invariants. Here it's an even stronger assumption because there are higher order E7 invariants. So the u-duality group, I should have said, is some integer subgroup of E7. So this is the unique quartic charge invariant of the continuous version of the group. And so even for the continuous version of the group, you can define higher order charge invariants, which aren't quartic, but say sextic or octic. And so we're just going to assume that our degeneracies don't depend on it. That's a much stronger assumption. So, OK. But without it, we can make a more restricted statement or claim about these degeneracies. I'll discuss this in a second. Okay, we can consider the same D62D0 brain configuration as before, and the same chain of dualities yields now a D1, D5 system on T4 times S1 instead of K3 plus 1. So the charges now are related much as before, and by the 4D5 correspondence, we can get a formula for D4 once we know D5. And this should be easy to derive since we know the answer of K3 times S1. Except for the complication, which is that the elliptic genus of the symmetric product of n copies T4 vanishes because of the extra supersymmetry. Okay, so that's unfortunate. So one simple thing to consider now is instead the modified elliptic genus, in which we insert extra powers of the U1R charge here. And okay, so this is called modified elliptic genus, and it will compute in general some degeneracy C5, and we can form again a generating function for them, and then we can go look in the literature and find that this guy was calculated by Malvo, Tanamore, and Strominger a while ago, and it looks like this. Okay, so this formula is has some is similar in spirit to what we had before in that it involves the elliptic genus coefficients of a single T4, which are given by this formula here. Unfortunately, though, it's kind of complicated because it involves this extra sum over S here, which means that we can't just read off the degeneracies from this formula, because in general, different values of S will contribute to the same term in the sum. Okay, the only case where that doesn't happen is when K, N, and L, these indices here are coprime, in which case there's only one S, S equals 1, which contributes to the sum. Okay, in that case, we can just read off the degeneracy. And so that's the statement of this equation here. So in that case, the degeneracies are given by the coefficients of the sum, the C hats. And so when K and L are coprime, the 5 to degeneracy is just C hat. And by the 45 to correspondence, we have this. Notice now that something interesting just happened. This C hat is a it depends only on this combination of K and L. And if we now use the 45-degree correspondence to write K and L in terms of these charges here, we find that this is precisely the Kramer-Julian variance that I wrote down before. So that's nice. That tells us that the 5D formula had a hidden invariance, which we only see. So this hidden invariance we only see using the 45-degree correspondence. Okay, so clearly we can get every value of J by an appropriate choice of coprime charges. And so assuming that D4 only depends on J, we have this formula now for the 4D degeneracies. Okay? If you don't assume this, then at least you can say that D4 is C hat of J when these things are coprime. And physically, this corresponds to the case where the black hole cannot fragment into smaller black holes. So when they're not coprime, you have to worry about black hole fragmentation. That's why physically there could be something wrong with assuming that it all depends on J. Okay. So short calculation gives us the 4D degeneracies completely, and it looks like this. It's so this is our generating function for the 4D degeneracies. Notice that it's a modular form, which an SL2Z. So these are theta functions. Jacobi theta function. So this thing is a modular form under SL2Z, which is similar in spirit to the n equals 4 result where we had this extra SP2Z invariance that popped out of nowhere. Here we're getting an extra SL2Z invariance, covariance that pops out of nowhere. Interesting to see what that means. Okay, so to summarize so far, we're almost done. To summarize, we've derived formulas for n equals 4 and n equals 8 large black hole degeneracies, and they look like this. The n equals 4 result precisely reproduces the old conjecture of BBV, and the second one is entirely new. Okay? All right, so in the last few minutes of the talk, I'd like to talk about the OSV transform of these guys, which is the original motivation, compare with the topological string and see what we get. You could say, well, these are only one example of degeneracies that you could consider for these black holes. Why are we OSV transformed from these? We have nothing better to do. So, and we'll see. We get something interesting, something pretty close to topological string at the end of the day. So, if someone can define another index and compute it exactly, we'd be happy to compute the OSV transform of that too. Okay. So I'm not going to go through the details of the calculation. It's very technical. But you know, this is what we ultimately want to calculate. We want to do this discrete Laplace transform over the electric charges Q, weighted by this potential phi, and up the degeneracies. And this is what we're going to compare to the topological string partition function squared. Okay. So the answer is this. It's kind of a mess. And I've split things up into red and blue because these will have two different interpretations. So this is the n equals 4 answer, and this is the n equals 8 answer. Notice right off the bat, there's a sum over phi which comes out of the calculation. And this precisely, this enforces the invariance that I discussed at the beginning, that the right-hand side, the degeneracy side, has under pi equals to pi plus 2 pi I times an integer. So this, so we see that we're not going to get exactly z top squared. We're getting some sum over something shifted by with phi shifts included. Okay, so the question we'd like to answer now is whether this mess has any interpretation in terms of the topological string. And to answer that, we have to, I have to tell you a bit about topological string on these caveats. So it's pretty trivial. The topological string pre-potential just truncates at one loop in both cases. For K3 times C2, you have this one loop. So in both cases, you have this classical cubic piece, which involves the intersection form on this on the caveat. So this is general, valid for any n. And then for K3 times C2, you have the specific one loop contribution here, which comes from Wolff-Sheed instant times, which wrap the T2. This here is the Taylor modulus of the T2. So these come from Wolff-Sheed instant times, which wrap the T2, and you get the 24 from that's the Euler character of K3. Okay? And T6, you don't even have this contribution of one loop, it just comes with the classical piece. Okay, so like I said at the beginning, these are examples where we know at least all orders of perturbation theory at the topological string side as well. So we can now compare it. And I should also say the statement of the attractor mechanism for in this context is that the Kähler moduli are fixed like this, and topological string is fixed like this, to depend on the charges and the potentials like that. Okay, so if you just plug this into here, and so then you can find that and compute z top squared, just plug that in there, compute z top squared, the first thing you'll note is that that gives you precisely these factors here. So you can see this exponential thing is the same in both cases, and if you do the algebra, you can find that this corresponds precisely to 2 times the real part of this guy after you substitute this in there. And you can see also the one loop piece coming out. That's easy to see because here we just plug in T1 into this eta function, and that's what we have here, the real part, the complex square of that, with the correct exponent 24.
Yeah, you mentioned before that the topological string partition function does not necessarily have the symmetry phi equals to phi plus.
That's right.
So, but apparently those examples that you considered, it does.
No, here it doesn't. Without this phi shift thing, sum over phi shifts, this thing is z top squared here, and this thing is z top squared.
So oh, okay. So it's not with it's not so it's without the summation.
Oh, without the summation, yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't yeah. Understand. Oh,
here,
okay.
This is f top, and we just square this guy. There's no sum.
So there is no sum.
So the sum comes out of the calculation, and apparently it's necessary.
So that's the first simplification to the old SVE formula that you have to add.
Yeah, I would say this. Okay, so I'll discuss this at the end. You asked whether this is, I expect this to be a general modification. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Discuss this at the end. Okay. So that explains these things in red. That's just the top squared. So that's nice. Now, what about the things in blue? Well, as you can see, they're very complicated. So now we have to do a bit of answer analysis. And we ask, what are the natural quantities to calculate in topological string? One natural quantity you could consider is the physical volume of the caveat. And this is determined by special geometry to be related to the Kähler potential as follows. And if you just plug in f top, as I had on the previous slide, you can compute this, and it looks like this, plus dot, 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 which are more complicated. Okay. So one funny thing that we're doing here, though, is that the usual formula for the volume involves only the classical piece. Special geometry is involves only the classical prepotential. But here we're plugging in the quantum prepotential, which includes this one loop fraction here. And so we're defining some sort of quantum volume for the caveat, which may or may not make sense. Okay, but the reason we're doing that is because we want to explain these complicated factors here. As you can see here, this leading term here is the volume times some power of phi naught. It is the volume here. And in addition, we have all this extra stuff for K3 times T2. We don't have it for T6. And Indeed, if you compute the quantum volume as I just defined it, you will find that all the blue stuff becomes basically this quantum volume. So that, I think, is very suggestive. I mean, all the coefficients work out exactly. There's no fudging here. Okay?
So is that a conjecture or?
No, this is a calculation.
That the volume is given by the more complicated terms?
Well, I've never seen it. Maybe somebody who knows more about this stuff can tell me, but I've never seen this quantum volume discussed in a rigorous way. We're just kind of defining it.
Oh, yeah, right.
Whether it means anything in reality. But it gives the right answer here. So that's, I think, analyzing. Unfortunately, it's an extra factor of details to the eighth, which we couldn't kill. But OK, so that's basically the final result for the OSV transform. We see that we come pretty close to the original proposal of OSV. We have z top squared times a volume factor, which is interesting. And it seems pretty simple. Seems like it should have a simple physical interpretation. And this embarrassing factor v top v8. OK, so that's the end of our analysis today. Many questions still remain to be answered, I think. Some of the more interesting reasons, some of the reasons people are interested in this OSV conjecture in the first place remain to be studied. So one of the reasons people are interested in the OSV, the topological string people at least, are interested in OSV because it seems to suggest some sort of thing that people have suspected for a long time, which is that the topological string is some kind of wave function on some space. Okay. This comes from the holomorphic Witten's original paper on the holomorphic anomaly, giving a physical interpretation to the holomorphic anomaly equations, where he showed that they tell you that the topological string, in some sense, is a wave function which is defined on sort of half of the space. So it involves some sort of symmetric symplectic splitting of the space into p and q, with the momentum and position. Okay, even with that work, it was never clear whether the topological string really has some real quantum mechanical interpretation. Is it a probability? Is the square of it a probability? On what space is it a probability? Is there some really simple physical thing going on here? Okay, so and that's one reason why people are interested in OSV, is that you get out of it this z top squared naturally, and that suggests that there's some probability measure going on here. And then the question is, what is the measure? What is it a probability density? What space is a probability density on? What is the measure factor? And what we obtain here looks suggestive, I think, like some sort of measure for the topological string wave function. So that it would be nice to have an interpretation for these in terms of some sort of measure factor. Okay. The other open question is this question about phi shifts, whether this is general or not, whether if you were to write down the final formulation of this OSV conjecture, if it exists, whether it would involve these phi shifts. Indeed, in the other examples people have studied in detail, to the same level of detail that we've studied here, this was work done by Mina Aganagic, Uguri, Salina, and Baca. They studied local clavials. So these local clavials correspond to certain topological twists of 2D Yang mills. And they studied both sides of the OSV correspondence in this case. And they found a similar sum over phi shifts, which there they had some, they're not quite sure what it means in that case either. It's not clear what the physical interpretation of this sum over phi shifts is, but it does appear to be, at least in the few examples that have been studied independently, it appears to be a general feature of the correspondence. Okay. And now some future directions, which I think are interesting. The first is to understand better the non-curvative corrections. I glossed over them, but they appear in the dot dot dots here. So I should have said, I guess, this thing is to all orders of perturbation theory, the complete calculation. And the dot dot dots are, we showed in the final paper I wrote with C, we showed that these dot dot dots are all genuinely non-perturbative. And they're non-perturbative, you could ask them what. Non-perturbative And so they go like e to the minus von Lacaviao over g times squared. So they're not derivative in topological string coupling squared. Okay, so it would be nice to understand these better. People have studied, in the context of this 2D Yang-Mills, there have been some talk about baby universes. So these non-curved fractions being related to black hole fragmentation, multi-black hole states, or the tower of them, or some sort of recursiveness. It would be nice to see if that's happening here. And I think the most important future direction is to just obtain more examples where we know both sides of the correspondence. One promising area, which seems like it's going to yield some fruit soon, is to generalize to other n equals 4 or even n equals 2 string theories, which are obtained from orbifolds of K3 to FT2. For instance, you could consider the CHL models, which were recently studied by Jadkar and Sen, and you can also study the FHSV model, which has n equals 2 supersymmetry. These are all relatively simple orbifolds of K3 times T2, which you might hope to get exact degeneracy formulas. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say.
Is there some way how I can think of a degenerate limit where K3 goes to T4 in such a way that I can understand the extra topological today factor?
If you go back, I thought about that. So I, yes?
Yeah, just.
You mean, oh, just that's, whether there's a way to go from that to that?
Right. Is there some way how I can. Well,
I think that's unlikely because the topological string here involves, there's no limit of this which takes it into that, as far as I know. Where you just deal with two, dial the K3 couplings. I mean, because this eta is a function of the T2, I don't see how you're going to make that go away if you don't simultaneously dial the T2.
So, and you're saying that it is from that, so the absence of that contribution in the T6 case that led to an extra factor?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying you asked whether there's some limit of the K3 which will bring it into this formula here.
Well,
but I'm saying that.
As you were saying, then the Calabi-Yau is actually holonomy, but if I start producing the holonomy, I can get, depending on how I define K3 times T2 or T6.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there's a limit in which you also dial the T2 parameters, in which case you can. I mean, even if you got this to agree, I'm not saying the z top squared here is hiding the extra factor of eta to the 24, which you'd have to kill that to set that to 1 somehow.
Yeah, but I would like to have some sort of I mean, if there is a physical interpretation, maybe of this extra volume factor, then
yeah,
you expect that to be independent of supersymmetry, and so.
Yeah, one speculation we had is that maybe this factor here is telling us something about the index we're ultimately computing here. I should note that the index we're computing here, it's not quite clear which. It was defined naturally in 5 dimensions as some 5D partition function, and we just use the 4D, 5D correspondence to say that it's 4D index as well.
Do you think that could be a factor?
Well, I'm saying it's not quite clear. So there is this list of Felicity supertraces that is natural in the 4D context. It's not quite clear which Felicity supertrace these are, or whether they could be linear combination of Felicity supertraces. So we haven't worked that out, and it's not clear. Yeah, what the answer is. And one speculation we had is that this G top of VA is somehow related to which index we're using in this example. Maybe this is the difference between different indices. If you use a different index to compute the OSP transform, you would get a different power. That would be very amazing, but kind of simple, is if that's the only difference for different indices. Yeah.
In order to count states, why do you use an index? I mean, in principle, you want to count every state that contributes to the entropy with a plus one. You don't actually want an index.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the index is a thing that you can easily calculate.
That's basically why we're doing it here. Yeah.
Otherwise, there's no reason for an index to actually be prevented.
Yeah, I mean, someone could compute the partition function weighted with the plus ones, some statement about the cohomology, and it's a number formula for it.
Check the final version of the whatever OSV conjecture. Mm-hmm. It really calculates the entropy.
Yeah, one possibility is that all of these, okay, I don't know. In these examples, one possibility is that the index we computed and the final entropy partition function that you might dream of computing, they could agree to all orders of perturbation theory and disagree. Not perturbative theory. I mean, the fact that we arrive at z top squared times this, if the entropy is also going to arrive at the same thing, then that would say that they could only disagree on perturbative.
I think Christian at least clarified this to me. So that was because, you know, the symmetric product and symmetric product of the in the first line you computed the exact degenerate. So you didn't have to insert into a partition function the U1 charge. In the first line.
Here, no. Well, in the 5, we computed this in 5D, and in 5D it is this elliptic genus, which right. Also has a minus 1 or something. So
it's not really a degeneracy with plus signs in neither case.
Yeah, and it's a supersymmetric bit. Okay.
But there is an extra difference for the T6 case.
Yeah, in the T6 case, not only do we have this minus 1, we have this extra insertion.
Right. So that could be the explanation. As you said, it could be just a different degeneration.
Yeah.
Okay.
More questions? Let's see.